here, and thank you for your support.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts. In April 2007, Sungwoo Cho, a student at Virginia Tech, shot and killed 32 classmates and teachers. His English teacher had noticed his bizarre behavior and encouraged him to get counseling. Now, 2 years later, Virginia Tech professor Lucinda Roy says the mysterious reappearance last week of his missing mental health records fuels concern of how Cho's case was handled. Professor Roy talked to Diane in April about her new book, No Right to Remain Silent. In it, she tells what steps she took to try to help Cho and what can be done to prevent similar tragedies.
Good morning, Lucinda. It's good to see you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Talk about your relationship with Cho.
Well, it began actually when he was in my class in spring 2004, and he was in a very large lecture class then, but I got to know him a little bit. And then in fall 2005, Professor Giovanni reported him to me, saying that he'd written a very disturbing poem.
This is Nikki Giovanni, the poet
herself.
The
famous poet. She said she was very concerned about it, and she asked me to take a look at it. When I read the poem, I could see why she was so concerned, and so I decided that I needed to share the poem with various people around campus and let them know that I was going to meet with Sungwoo Cho and talk with him and find out what was going on.
I understand that you would prefer not to disclose the contents of that poem, but can you give us a sense of why you found it so disturbing?
Well, it seemed as though he was very angry with the class because they'd been talking about eating various kinds of meats in class, and I think one had talked about eating turtle or something like that, and he felt that it was a depraved thing to do, and so his response had been to write this kind of tirade against the class and the professor, and it just, the tone seemed to be so angry, and it seemed as though that contrasted greatly with his demeanor, which was incredibly quiet and silent. And whenever you have a contrast like that as a teacher, then you have to start thinking that perhaps there could be something wrong, that in fact the rage could be quite pronounced.
So what action did you then take?
So I asked my assistant chair if she would meet Sungwoo Cho with me, because then she could take some notes, and I called him in for a meeting. His first email response, though, said something like, I know you're going to yell at me, but I'll come in. But that was such a strange response that I wrote back saying, you know, I'm not going to yell at you. I just want to find out what was going on with the poem. So he came in and sat down, and it was the strangest meeting in many ways that Cheryl Ruggiero and I had ever been through. He was wearing dark sunglasses that were reflective so you couldn't see his eyes. He had a cap pulled down over his head, and he would take between 10 to 20 seconds really to respond to almost any question.
What were the questions you were asking?
I asked him about the poem, and I actually read the poem to him to give him some sense of why people were upset with him. And he said that the poem was satirical, that it wasn't something, that he wasn't angry, and he couldn't understand why people would think he was angry. And I asked him a series of questions, the kinds of questions I usually ask students who seem to be troubled.
Such as,
was there anything that was troubling him? He seemed to be much quieter than he was when I knew him in spring 2004. And I didn't know whether that was really true, but it seemed to be a way to bring him to start speaking. And he did speak with us. He wasn't totally silent, but it seemed to be agony for him to respond. At the time, I didn't realize he suffered from selective mutism. I didn't didn't learn that until after the tragedy, and nobody at Virginia Tech knew that he suffered from that condition.
I've never heard of that condition.
Apparently, it's not as uncommon as we would think, and there's actually a Center for Selective Mutism in Pennsylvania that I've just learned about. But what's amazing about it is that it manifests itself differently. So in certain social situations, people just cannot speak. And I thought that he was just chronically shy. I've suffered from shyness in my own life and a slight stutter on occasion. So I thought, okay, he's very shy, and I'll try and be careful about how I handle things. I did ask him partway through the interview if he would take his sunglasses off, because as I explained to him, I couldn't see his eyes, and it just made it difficult for me.
And the eyes are so important.
Exactly. How do you communicate with anyone
exactly.
without seeing their eyes?
Exactly.
So I asked him to take his sunglasses off, and he did, but it seemed to be agony for him to do that. And so I actually apologized afterwards and said, I hope that that wasn't too painful for him to do, and he said that it wasn't, as I recall. Then in subsequent meetings, when he and I would meet together, I would, of course, ask him to take his sunglasses off, but I would always say, only if you feel comfortable doing it, could you do that? And in fact, he seemed to get very comfortable in the end with doing that, but at first it was hard.
Was there always a third person present?
No, that was the only time there
just
was.
Just the first time.
Yeah.
How many times did you then meet with him?
You know, we scheduled three times for the rest of the semester with me, and then once with Fred Degar, and then...
Who is Fred Degar?
Fred Degar is my colleague. At the time, he was co-director of the Creative Writing Program. He's a well-known Caribbean writer, really fine person, and a great friend. And he agreed to meet with him once because my schedule was just crazy. As it turned out, I think there was one meeting that Sung-Woo Cho had to reschedule, and I may have met him either two or three times apart from those two or three times that I'd scheduled, because my schedule was so difficult that it was often hard to know when I could meet him, and I had to squeeze him in at the last moment sometimes.
And then, finally, you decided you did not have the training to work with him.
Well, in fact, I decided that very early on, as soon as I met with him. I had a protocol whereby I would call all the units on campus if I was really worried about a student. That had only happened one time before in the spring of that year, spring 2005. We'd had another student that I had been very worried about that other teachers did not want to have in their classes, and the only option I was given as chair of the department was to put him in somebody else's class.
Ah.
I felt that that was, quite frankly, ridiculous. And it annoyed me and actually infuriated me, because it meant that I felt I had to put myself in jeopardy because I needed to take that student on myself. So as it turned out, that turned out to be a catastrophic thing in many ways, not nearly as bad, of course, as what happened with Sung-Woo Cho. But because of my experience with that other troubled student, I tried to get people together. We had a meeting in the spring of 2005, well before Sung-Woo Cho, just to talk about these issues, and so that I could let people know that when you reported troubled students, you could end up infuriating the student who would be very, very angry with you for a long time afterwards. That particular student is still very angry with me and with other faculty members at Virginia Tech. So I felt that we needed to learn from that, and we needed to have some other protocol. But I was not allowed to require counseling. I could not require a student to go to counseling.
Why not?
Quite frankly, that's such a good question. I'm hoping maybe Ed Spencer later today, if he's going to speak for Virginia Tech, will answer that question. In those days, it just was something that we were not permitted to do.
Let's hear now from Dr. Edward Spencer. He's Vice President of Student Affairs at Virginia Tech. He's worked at that university for 27 years. Good morning, Dr. Spencer.
Good morning. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you for being with us. Can you answer the question that Lucinda Roy has just posed, namely, why she, as a teacher, was not allowed to recommend that a student go into counseling?
Well, I think there's a difference between recommending counseling and requiring counseling. Also, I think sometimes when we talk about this area, there are two terms that get confused, mandatory counseling versus mandatory assessment. We have always had as a part of our university policies a procedure for mandatory assessment. That has been a part of our interim suspension policy where a student might be considered a danger to oneself or others. And as part of that process, there is a mandatory assessment that can be done, has always been able to be done as part of the counseling center. I think with Mr. Cho's case, at the time of December 05, the fall of 05 that Lucinda is talking about, he did not impress anyone who had evaluated his writings and the conversations as a danger to himself or others. He was strange. He was different. He was described as quiet. You've heard Lucinda's descriptions, which I think were probably pretty accurate. But nowhere along the line was he assessed as being a danger to himself or others.
All right. We're going to have to take a short break here. Dr. Spencer, I hope you'll stay with us. Lucinda Roy is with me. Her book is titled No Right to Remain Silent, The Tragedy at Virginia Tech.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Coming up at 11 on A Prairie Home Companion, it's from the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. And then at 1 is Car Talk on WAMU 88.5. Complete schedules are at WAMU.org.
Coming up Monday on The Kojo Nandi Show, A Green Agenda for D.C., how federal stimulus funds are being used to make the city eco-friendly, and how residents can reduce their own environmental footprint. Plus, a hometown radio pioneer, WAMU's Ed Walker, on his nearly 60 years in the business. From his radio program with Willard Scott, the Joy Boys, to the big broadcast, we look at Ed's greatest hits. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 Monday, on WAMU 88.5.
Gas prices go up, gas prices go down. But one thing is certain, our economic situation is uncertain. If you've decided to cut back on the vehicles in your family, consider the WAMU 88.5 vehicle donation program. It may qualify for a tax deduction and will gladly arrange for it to be picked up. Call 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org for more information. Thanks.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And joining us now from Virginia Tech is the Vice President of Student Affairs, Dr. Edward Spencer. And just before the break, Dr. Spencer, you were saying that while the assessment may be there, you cannot force a young person into counseling. You also maintain that no one other than Lucinda Roy saw these writings as being dangerous or a threat. And therein lies really a rather large gap. Who was doing the interpreting, and why is it that Lucinda Roy came to the conclusion, reported her conclusion, and yet other people ignored that? How do you see it, Lucinda?
And in fact, I should stress that Nikki Giovanni was the first person to see this as something that was threatening and dangerous, and because of the tone of the poem. And I really think that she needs to be applauded for that, that in fact it was a brave thing to do, even to report the student, because remember, if you report someone, that student probably knows that you've reported him.
And knows the identity of the person who's reported it.
Exactly.
Dr. Spencer, so now you have two people both Nikki Giovanni and Lucinda Roy, both of whom felt this young man was not only a danger to himself, but a danger to others.
Right. But at that point, when those concerns came forward, they were evaluated, his writings and the conversations that she had had by Virginia Tech Police, by our Office of Judicial Affairs, and by our counseling center, our Cook Counseling Center. So professionals who deal with the reality of these situations were taking a look at this and did not find that there was a real direct threat to anyone. They were viewed as you know, a form of creative writing. Sure, many forms of creative writing can be disturbing, and Lucinda could certainly much more of an expert on that than I would be. But at the time, they were not viewed as a threat, either to himself or to others. In fact, as the semester went on, and we finally came sort of to a culmination point in December of that semester, Mr. Cho was evaluated by three different psychologists from the Cook Counseling Center, twice on the phone and once in person. And also, as a precaution, we sought a temporary detaining order to have him hospitalized in our local mental health facility and evaluated. And he was evaluated there by at least two professionals, I believe one a psychologist and one a psychiatrist, and was released following his hearing and released with the comment that he was not a danger to himself or others. So nowhere along the line was that diagnosis made. In that fall of 2005, Lucinda indicated to several of the staff in student affairs that she had worked out this arrangement with Mr. Cho, thanked our offices in the division for their help, and indicated that she was going to move on, was satisfied with this arrangement. So,
and if I may just say something in response to that, Ed, it's lovely to talk with you. I'm so glad, by the way, that I'm at last allowed to speak to you and we could talk about some of these topics, because I've been desperate to do that. And as you know, I've been trying for open communication at Virginia Tech for a long time. So I'm thrilled that we're talking about this. I do want to emphasize that you're absolutely right, that student affairs was really important, and Tom Brown was magnificent in this particular capacity.
They Tom really Brown tried to help being...
me. He was the... In fact, he was the director of student life and advocacy at that time. And he was just magnificent. So was Zenobia Hikes, who's died since then. She was she had Ed Spencer's position at the time, and she was just magnificent. But I know you'll recall, Ed, because you've been involved in some of this with me, that in fact, this was not a new situation. For months, ever since the problems with another student the previous semester, I had been asking Virginia Tech to try to respond in a much more comprehensive way to students who were deemed to be a problem. And you know that I tried to get the police involved, the College of Liberal Arts and Human Sciences, Cook Counseling Center, the Women's Center, Student Affairs, and that in fact we'd had a meeting in the spring about this. And so you do know that this had been going on for a long time. The other thing I would like to ask you about is the Cook Counseling Center, that all of that documentation seems to have been lost. And it seems to be so important and so crucial to us, to understanding about Sung-Wee Cho. I wonder if you could comment on that and let me know where it is, because I would love to look at it. I think we could learn a lot.
I don't think we're ever going to know exactly what happened to the records in this case. I would clarify one thing. It was not a matter that all of Mr. Cho's records were missing. Some of them were missing, and we believe it has to do with the translation of handwritten notes into computer records. And somewhere along the line, some of those notes, those particular notes of the various therapists, were lost. But we know enough from the files that were there to put the pieces together of the evaluations that were done by these three professionals. I would also comment the records of Mr. Cho that are missing were not the only records in the center that were missing. There were other cases where there were missing notes from some of the therapists, so it wasn't like it was just this only case.
Why would those notes have been missing?
Diane, I don't know. I think that would be pure speculation to, you know, try to come up with reasons of why they would be missing. But as I said, it was just not notes from Mr. Cho's case. It was notes from a number of cases as we did a careful audit in the center.
All right. And joining us now is Dr. Carol Bernstein. She's president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. She joins us now from NPR's New York studios. Good morning, Dr. Bernstein. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Talk about the incident that happened recently in Binghamton and the kinds of parallels you see between what happened there and what happened at Virginia Tech.
Well, I think whenever incidents like this happen, where there is a terrible tragedy where a lot of innocent people lose their lives, it's very traumatic for everybody that's involved. And, you know, there's a big attempt to do kind of Monday morning quarterbacking. What did we miss? What could we have seen? How could we have prevented it? And I just want to say, particularly since we're talking here with Dr. Spencer and Dr. Roy, that I was quite touched, Dr. Roy, in your description of your interactions with this sad young man, because I think he was, I know this is going to sound somewhat paradoxical, he was fortunate to have somebody with your sensitivity and awareness in contact with him, because often the kind of behavior that he, not often, but sometimes the kind of behavior that he seems to have displayed is the type of behavior that people avoid and run away from. And it sounds to me like you really tried to help him as best you could. And I think that, you know, also with the events in Binghamton, people are looking for reasons to try to understand what happened, and don't pay enough attention to the fact that there may be many potential scenarios like this that have been avoided and prevented. But of course, we don't hear about them because they don't happen.
Dr. Bernstein, were there warning signs in the Binghamton incident that may have been similar to those which occurred at Virginia Tech?
Well, I don't really know, because I haven't read closely enough about what has been reported about the gentleman's behavior before he opened fire. I mean, I know that he was upset about not having a job and was upset about his English. I'm not really sure. But certainly, you can look to people to see if they feel despondent, depressed, if they become preoccupied with thoughts of violence and you hear about it. I mean, I don't know what was in the poem in the case of the Virginia Tech student, but if there's violent imagery, preoccupation with guns, those things are all warning signs. Mm. And we would rather that people be educated about them and be on the alert for them to see if there are ways to get people the help that they need before tragedies like these happen.
Dr. Roy, you have written in your book, quote, "I am concerned that there is a perfect storm brewing in education, a chronic lack of well-trained, experienced teachers, the lack of treatment facilities for the mentally ill, the availability of bomb-making materials, the bullying of students, and the frequency of depression and suicide among the young."
I really do believe that that's something that we've got to think about, which is why this discussion is so important. We can't just turn away from this subject, nor can we just react emotionally after something has happened. We have to think very carefully about what we're really doing to education, and we've got to prioritize it. It seems to me, having heard from hundreds of people around the country who are in similar situations, who write to me saying, "I have Sungwee Cho in my class," or, "I go to bed at night and I am terrified that a student is going to be off his meds tomorrow," or parents who say, "I cannot get a temporary detention order for my son and he is dangerous. I know he's going to do something." We have hardly any psychiatric beds in this country anymore. We've really got to look at this to see where we can deal
with it. Dr. Roy, where were you on April 16th, 2007?
It was a Monday morning, so I was preparing for my graduate class in the evening. It was a 3-hour poetry workshop. And I turned on the television, and Blacksburg came up on a map on CNN. And I thought, oh, there's been some incident or accident. And then I realized it had been a shooting, and I thought it must be like the previous shooting we'd had a few months ago, where a young man had killed a security guard and a deputy sheriff. And I thought, okay, we're going to see something like that. And then as the morning progressed, and I would get calls from people on campus who'd been listening to the communication between the police and emergency people, telling me that maybe this was something truly terrible. But I didn't believe it until I saw on CNN that there had been so many killed, and at least 20 was the first real catastrophic estimate. But I didn't know then that it was the perpetrator was someone I knew. I had no idea about that.
How long afterwards did you find that out?
In fact, I didn't find out till the next morning. So that afternoon of April 16th, the New York Times called me and asked if I would do an op-ed. So I wrote the op-ed for them, not realizing that it was my student who'd actually killed everyone. And when I learned the next morning, the op-ed came out, and then I got the news that it was Sung-Wee Cho on Tuesday morning.
Dr. Spencer, if I could turn to you, there have been some questions about why the rest of the student body was not notified, alerted, after the initial shooting, which occurred at 7:15 a.m., and the bodies were discovered 9 minutes later. What was the delay?
Well, at first, I think we believed that it was a very isolated shooting. After all, as Lucinda described, it was a very cold, snowy Monday morning in Blacksburg, and this was a murder that had occurred up on the fourth floor of a residence hall. And I think there was just no belief that that would lead to something else at all. In fact, there'd never been instances of mass killings and killings on campuses where it started out as a separate, isolated event, and then this person went on to engage in mass killings.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But then the criticism became that even if it were an isolated shooting, shouldn't the rest of the campus have been notified immediately?
Well, I think there was an effort not to panic the campus, and Lucinda's reference to our earlier incident is certainly a piece of that. Also, you have to realize there was an active police investigation going underway at that point, and I think there was an effort not to jeopardize that investigation. And as the minutes went on, there was a person of interest in the case that the police were eventually able to stop and question. So those were the various reasons, I think, that went into that.
Which was such a mistake. What lessons do you think were learned from that delay?
Well, first let me say, you know, it really wasn't custom in the country to issue a reverse 911 for shootings anywhere in the United States.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by reverse 911.
Essentially, instead of a person calling in an emergency, the administration, the police department, whatever, calls out an emergency to everyone. The other thing is, at that point, and ever since, we never had any witnesses. We would have no idea who we were looking for and whether we had ever found the person. So that would have been quite an issue, I think, during those hours immediately afterwards.
Dr. Roy,
Again, Ed, I'm so glad we're talking about this. As you know, on campus, this is a subject that is pretty much banned. We're not allowed to say the word Sungwi Cho, and we're not really allowed to talk about the two-hour delay. So I think this is a huge step forward. One thing I would say to you, and this is why it's so important to learn from this, and this is what I wanted to write about. You say you don't have isolated shootings before you have an attack. In fact, if you think about the Kip Kinkle case, for example, he killed his parents first, and then went to the school and killed all kinds of people. In fact, it's not that unusual to have school shooters practice for the mass murders they want to do by killing people first. What also is confusing to me is that as there were bloody footprints leading away from that first double homicide, then it would make people feel, you know, at the very least, very uncomfortable. I mean, it does suggest that the person who committed the crime took off and could be anywhere. And I think that that's one of the reasons why people, it's not that everybody wants to accuse everybody else or play Monday morning quarterback or anything like that. I think it's that people are genuinely puzzled by this and they just want to find out the answers. So the fact that you're communicating about this openly is just wonderful.
Dr. Lucinda Roy, her new book is titled No Right to Remain Silent, The Tragedy at Virginia Tech. We hope all our guests will stay with us. We'll be right back.
Good morning. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Coming up next, it's Prairie Home Companion, and at 1, it's Car Talk. Complete schedules are at WAMU.org.
Next time on Interfaith Voices, we look at the historic votes in the Episcopal Church in favor of gay and lesbian rights. I'm Maureen Fiedler. Join me next time as we explore what these decisions mean for the Episcopal Church and for mainstream Protestants generally. That's Interfaith Voices.
Today at 3 on WAMU 88.5.
On the next The State We're In, we ask if there's a right to die with dignity. And does that include euthanasia?
People in the beginning, in the early stages of Alzheimer, do they have the right to ask for death? Well, you can ask for anything, but will you hand it to them? And yes, we do in certain cases.
The right to die with dignity in the next edition of The State We're In.
And that's coming up today at 4 on WAMU 88.5.
Coming up Tuesday on the Kojo Nandi Show, a Tech Tuesday conversation with Facebook's chief Washington lobbyist. Tim Sparapani spent years as a leading watchdog for online privacy. Now he's the voice for the Internet's top social networking site. Facebook comes to Washington this Tech Tuesday, noon till 2 on WAMU 88.5.
In the Washington area, information is a hot commodity, and that information is available on NPR Mobile. It provides the latest news through the web browser on your mobile device at wamu.npr.org. Listen to local headlines, weather, and traffic. Plus, get national headlines and the story of the day from NPR. WAMU 88.5 and NPR. Information on demand at wamu.npr.org.
Showers and thunderstorms are likely this afternoon. Some could be severe, high in the upper 80s. 79 degrees right now in northwest Washington at 10:39.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And we're back. Joining us by phone is from his office at Virginia Tech is Dr. Edward Spencer. He's vice president for Student Affairs at the university, joining us from the NPR studios in New York, Dr. Carol Bernstein, president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. Here in the studio, Lucinda Roy, former chair of the Department of English at Virginia Tech. Her new book is titled No Right to Remain Silent, The Tragedy at Virginia Tech. Let's go first to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning, Diane. Can you hear me?
I certainly can. Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking the call. And good morning, Ed and Lucinda. It's Jean Hammond. And as you know, having spent as many years as I did in Blacksburg and Guy's career, this is something I've been very concerned about. First, I'd like to get your reaction to this comment. To me, the word massacre that has been used in the media is misguided, since for Virginia Tech and the surrounding area, that really connotes Indians and tomahawks and trivializes what has happened. And more importantly, Lucinda, your title resonates with me because I struggled with the laws that required us as academic advisors not to talk to parents or divulge information about their grades, much less their psychological situation, which would have been applied here. Is there any hope of getting that changed in a legal sense as well as other ways?
Dr. Roy.
In fact, I believe it's Jim Webb, and maybe Ed, you all know more about this, who's introduced a safe harbor provision that would allow teachers to react more appropriately to these kinds of things, and should mean that they would not be litigated for so doing. Because what the danger is, unfortunately, is that you really can be liable for reporting troubled students, particularly if you call their parents. So I think that would be a step in the right direction. There are a number of things that need to be changed so that we can intervene more effectively. You're absolutely right about that.
Dr. Spencer, have some of the rules been changed since the killing?
I think the rules have been clarified for everyone, and actually FERPA, which is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, has always allowed, for instance, universities to discuss information with parents whenever the student is a dependent of the parent in terms of income tax purposes, whenever the student gives permission to allow that. And by the way, we've built in a very automatic, simple system for students to allow administrators and faculty to talk to their parents about any of the educational records. And then in any kind of a situation where the student is viewed in an emergency or danger to himself or others, then that's always been allowed under FERPA.
Isn't the difficulty that it's so difficult to be able to determine that the student is a danger to himself or others unless he makes some kind of explicit threat? And that's still very difficult. I know you'll agree with me, Ed, that it's almost impossible sometimes, however threatening someone seems, if there's not some kind of explicit threat, it can be very difficult to intervene.
And here's go right ahead, sir.
I think that we have always engaged in calling parents when we feel that a student has really gone to a point that we need parents to intervene.
Of course, Ed, though, you would agree, would you not, that at the time when I was working with Sungwee Cho, then that was not the case, that in fact we were all instructed, and in fact staff even had to be trained to say to parents that they could not disclose anything. And that is one of the reasons why we were criticized so much in the panel report. You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Not totally, Lucinda. I think that we've always had the ability to communicate with parents if we really felt there were an emergency, a threat situation.
Well, then if you believe that, then we too should have had you should have communicated to us that we had the ability to do it, because in fact what was communicated was exactly the opposite. And I do think there are many other people at Virginia Tech who could vouch for that, that was something that we had real problems with at the time, though things have improved.
Dr. Bernstein, how important do you think that is? That is that ability on the part of a professor in whose class perhaps a disturbed student may be, that professor has the right to speak with the parents in an open and honest way.
I think it's incredibly important, and one of the hopeful side effects of the tragedy at Virginia Tech is that people will be encouraged to speak more openly and will feel that they have the opportunity to do so, which is why I like the title of Dr. Roy's book. My understanding, as Dr. Spencer was saying, is that under FERPA, schools may release any and all may disclose information from education records to parents if a health or safety emergency involves their son and daughter. And I think, unfortunately, in our culture, people are too afraid to step forward when they are concerned, and everybody's afraid that they're going to get sued. And, you know, I think I can't speak, obviously, to what happened specifically at Virginia Tech, but I would encourage school officials and educators to be open and communicative, and at the very least go to speak themselves to people at the counseling service who can often be a support. So that way, I mean, one avenue, I don't know if this was, you know, done at Virginia Tech, but one thing that I often tell parents or friends or relatives who are concerned about someone that they know is that they themselves should be encouraged to go speak to a psychiatrist and get some advice about what they can do. And that at least will get people into talking about it more and trying to see how they can get people the help that they deserve and that can really make a difference.
Here's an email. It seems that English professors are often on the front line when identifying troubled students. That troubled nature is revealed through poetry, creative writing, composition. What are universities doing to train professors in recognizing warning signs?
Let me comment on that, if I can, Diane, because we probably have gone way the extra mile here. We have developed training programs for our faculty and staff that have been run by the director of our counseling center and the dean of students, and they have gone out to various departments on campus, and they have actually videotaped their workshop that anyone in the world can go to our dean of students webpage on the Virginia Tech page and download that training session. And it gives faculty and staff some suggestions of how to spot disturbing and disturb students. And in cooperation, actually, with the English department, there is a supplement to that on dealing with creative writing and spotting disturbing behavior in creative writing.
Let me understand, Dr. Roy, were you at any time tempted to go to the students' parents?
It was difficult in Sung Wee Cho's case. I actually am always tempted to go to the students' parents. I have to answer honestly if I think they're really troubled. One thing you do have to be careful of is abuse. And unfortunately, Sung Wee Cho did seem to me to be someone who possibly had suffered from abuse, and I did convey that to the counseling center. And so, you know, I do think that it is very important that we contact the parents. I did get one note, though, from someone who had been through a similar situation where, in fact, her parents had been contacted. Not at Virginia Tech, this was a long time ago at another institution. And she wrote to me and said, please be careful if you contact parents. That happened to me, and I was being so severely abused by my father that when he heard that I'd gone to the counseling center, I got the worst beating of my life and nearly died.
Here's an email from Daniel in Oakton, Virginia, who says, I find it incredible that a VA official, a VA tech official, would attempt to justify missing medical records of Mr. Cho by saying that others were lost as well. If the system of counseling was so flawed as to allow loss of records, then perhaps that speaks to the quality of the evaluation and conclusions that he was not a threat. Dr. Spencer.
I don't think I was justifying the loss of records. I was explaining what we believe might have been the case, and we certainly have taken corrective actions in the counseling center to make sure that doesn't happen again.
All right. To Fort Wayne, Indiana, Tenneville, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. A member of my family exhibits behavior so similar to the profile of Mr. Cho, it's really disturbing to me. The boy is only 9 years old, and it's taken years to convince his parents that his behavior is abnormal, and he's only now going to see a psychiatrist. And it's very difficult to see this happening at a distance in slow motion and see the potential tragedy, you know, years ahead when the boy is grown up, but not to be able to do anything about it. And, you know, even when parents are notified and parents are participating, still, if nothing has happened yet, there's nothing anybody can do.
And Dr. Berenstain, can you comment?
Well, I think it's the good news in this case is that it sounds like the child actually got to see someone. And, you know, I mean, children are in the care of their parents. And I think the most that teachers can do in those circumstances is to try to reach out to the parents, unless, of course, they feel that there is an abusive situation, in which case, you know, I think most state laws have requirements that people then report any concerns about abuse of children to the authorities and let them do an investigation. But what I really want to stress is that there is treatment available and that it's very important to try to make accessible good treatment for everyone, both on the college campus and off the college campus. And I think we've had a big problem in our country so far with really limited access to good mental health services
now, of course,
for most of our population.
Dr. Roy and Professor Nikki Giovanni both had this warning sign. Dr. Berenstain, how would you outline major warning signs that people should be aware of?
Well, I think they were very smart in picking up warning signs in this case. I think that there are many that you can see. If people have intense anger, depression, suicidal thoughts or actions, often people assume that just because somebody talks about suicide, maybe they're not serious. Any conversation about suicide or violence is something to pay attention to and to suggest or try to help people get assistance with it. Prolonged low self-esteem, recent losses, disappointments, and rejections can be triggers. Histories of abuse or neglect, social isolation, family problems, drug or alcohol abuse. You know, we've certainly seen a lot about bullying, and, you know, there's a lot now about cyberbullying. Certainly in younger children, a history of stealing, fire setting, interactions with law enforcement, and preoccupation with violent or morbid themes or fantasies, which is where I think the creative writing piece may come in.
Indeed.
I mean, not, you know, there is creative license, but I think you have to look at that in the context of the total student. And it certainly seems like in the case of the student at Virginia Tech that there were other concerns that people had, the dark glasses, the isolation, the withdrawal. All of those were important warning signs.
All right. You had 6 minutes before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show and to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Diane. I am so grateful that I'm on the air. As I told your producer, I had to pull off the highway. I'm sitting in a parking lot. This hits so close to home for me, and I have three parts to what I'd like to say, and I'll try to be concise. What I want to say first is the child that I'm going to talk about is my daughter. And the good news is she's now living on her own in Chicago, a tremendous success. She's a photographer, and if you would have told me in the midst of this madness that this would be the outcome, I would have said, I want some of the crack that you're smoking, because never, never did I believe that we would get out of this black pit. So I say that so that people know that there is treatment available. However, the treatment that's available is so sparse and is so expensive. And if you're a middle-class family with other children, as my husband and I were, we had to have our daughter arrested and held overnight in the juvenile detention center before we were able to crack into Missouri's mental health system for her. She assaulted my husband in the garage. My husband's a big man. She assaulted him. I called the police. I had to beg the police to take her. Thirdly, the qualities that Dr. Roy was just lauded for by the woman from the Psychiatric Association, you know, her empathy and her understanding, those are precisely the qualities that allowed her to know that this man was troubled. And instead of being listened to, she was
I don't know if poo-pooed is too strong of a word, but I had the same experience when my daughter was three. Her coloring and her coloring books went from a normal coloring to where every face was scribbled over with black.
Oh, Barbara, I'm so sorry you had that experience. I hope your daughter continues to do well. Dr. Roy, what are the lessons you take away from this horrendous experience?
You know, one of the things that I think that I've learned that phone call just reminded me of again is that so many of us are journeying along the same path, that all of us know people like this, that if we just open our eyes and our ears, we will hear them and see them. And it is our moral obligation. And I say this to Virginia Tech because I don't know how many chances I'll get. We must speak about this openly. If we do not, if we clamp down and encourage people to remain silent, there will be stories that will never be told and catastrophes that will happen.
Lucinda Roy, her book is titled No Right to Remain Silent, The Tragedy at Virginia Tech. Dr. Carol Bernstein is president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association, and Dr. Edward Spencer, vice president for student affairs at Virginia Tech University. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5, followed by Car Talk at 1. Complete schedules are at WAMU.org.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Ascendio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
In 2008, the Department of Homeland Security reported that more than 60,000 people entered the U.S. as refugees, and an additional 23,000 were granted asylum.
The International Rescue Committee's Suburban Washington Resettlement Center promotes self-sufficiency by providing English lessons, employment and education services, cultural education, and temporary financial support.
The center needs new or gently used furniture, household items, and volunteers for its adopt-a-family and health promotion programs. It also needs community partners to provide housing or employment.
The Office of Migration and Refugee Services